I'm going to offer some reflections this afternoon on the idea of the lay Buddhist, the lay person. It's, I think, clear probably to most of us that Buddhism historically has been a tradition very much dominated by monasticism. And the Buddhist monk or nun is considered somehow the exemplary role model of how a good Buddhist should be. I was a Buddhist monk myself for 10 years, both in Tibetan and Korean Zen orders, and it was entirely explicit that if one sought to realize the goals of the Dhamma, one would be best advised to devote oneself to a monastic way of life, thereby disentangling one from the duties and burdens of the householder and dedicating oneself entirely to the process of meditation, of study, of reflection that would lead ultimately to what is called enlightenment or awakening, and in the end to liberation from the cycle of birth and death. So this model is one that emphasizes separation from the activities of social existence, and it emphasizes the importance of interiority. Meditation, of course, being the best example of that, but very much about returning to the contemplation of one's condition as a human being and seeking insight, liberating insight that frees one from the entanglements within the world. And that is, as it were, the sort of paradigm within which Buddhism is presented to us very often today. There are exceptions, but that, I would say, is the dominant paradigm. And much of the classical literature, in whatever school of Buddhism you go to, will tend to amplify that aspect of the practice. The people you'll read about or you'll hear giving wise advice will tend to be monastics. And in that respect, as a lay person, I've now been a lay Buddhist for longer than I've ever been a monk. I disrobed in 1985. That's, quick, what's the math on that? That's nearly 25 years ago or 24 years ago. And through that period, I've been asking myself, what does it mean to be a lay person in this tradition? What examples do I find in the tradition where I hear not monastic voices addressing me, but lay voices addressing me? And I hear very, very little. Virtually none. And very often the lay person who is somehow set up as a good example turns out to be a kind of monk in lay clothing. In other words, again, emphasizing the same set of priorities and values as the monk would, but somehow this person has managed to do that within the context of lay life. So again, it's hardly an affirmation of the laity. I feel that, nonetheless, Buddhism is known to us from far more than merely what the classical text and the traditional teachings tell us. And in particular, I started paying more and more attention to how Buddhism communicates non-verbally through its art. That when I look at let's say a scroll painting, whether it's Chinese or Japanese, Tibetan, when I visit classical temples in India or Tibet or China or Java or wherever they are, when I look at the poetry that has been written, when I consider all of these artifacts, even the most simple ones like the paper lanterns that are put out at ceremonies, the ways in which the objects of Buddhist reverence are laid out on the altars. Very non-verbal, very functional aspects of the tradition, which very often, probably more so than not, are the work, are the craft of lay people whose voices are otherwise silent. The most striking example of this recently was when I went last year for the first time to visit the cave temples of Ajanta and Ellora, which are in the central western India, near the city of Aurangabad. And here you find these temples, they're not cave temples really, they're monoliths. In other words, they are chipped out of the mountainside. They're man-made monoliths. And they're not done with pneumatic drills, they're done with chisels. And they're not done in wimpy sandstone, but in black basalt. Now, some of these temples go 30 meters into the mountainside, and they are exact replicas of the interior of a Buddhist temple that otherwise would have stood freestanding out in the environment. All of those have disappeared from India. The only Buddhist temples that survive are those that are essentially voids inside rock faces, and they are carved exquisitely, in high detail at times, and there's a sense of sitting in these spaces where you cannot help but be awed by the craftsmanship, by the dedication, by the sense of proportion, all of those qualities which are comparable in a way to sitting in a Gothic cathedral or a beautiful church here in the West. There's something rather sublime that comes through that, that is not the work of monks. So in some ways I feel a strong resonance with the artisans of Buddhist history, about whom we know nothing. We know none of their stories, their biographies, we know nothing of their degrees of understanding, what their philosophy of life was. All that we can know of them is communicated to us through their work. So in some ways I feel that what I would like to do is help these silent people find a voice. Now, having said all of this, it is nonetheless the case that we do find in the Pali Canon passages where the Buddha quite explicitly affirms that amongst his followers there are very many accomplished lay people. This is a passage from one of the discourses in the Middle Length Sayings. The Buddha is speaking, he says, there are not only 100 or 500, but far more men and women lay followers, clothed in white, enjoying sensual pleasures. I particularly like that bit. who carry out my instructions, respond to my advice, have gone beyond doubt, become free from perplexity, gained intrepidity, and become independent of others in their understanding. Now, this is somewhat coded language, but especially the last sentence, have become independent of others in their understanding, means that they have entered the path, they have entered the stream. They've become independent of the authority of, in what most cases would be, some sort of monastic figure or monastic authority. They've become their own persons. And this is one of the definitions of what it means, really, to have woken up, to have gained some kind of enlightenment. From that point on, you are autonomous in your practice. Now, historically, most examples of that, as I've said, would be monks, but here we have a passage which very clearly affirms that people in ordinary life can achieve and have achieved the same degrees of awakening, of insight, of understanding, of autonomy. I more and more suspect that this dimension of the non-monastic lay community has been somehow excluded, somehow brushed over, somehow ignored in the history of the tradition. It seems to me that after the Buddha's death, his community was very much taken over by monks who were concerned that Buddhism be another way of realizing the soteriological goals of Indian tradition, namely liberation from birth and death, liberation from samsara. And that becomes very early on the overriding emphasis. But we have a very striking passage which suggests that the Buddha was not actually entirely concerned with this sort of transcendence. This is the parable of the city. The Buddha's speaking. He says, suppose a man wandering through a forest would see an ancient path, an ancient road traveled upon by people in the past. He would follow it and would see an ancient city, an ancient capital that had been inhabited by people in the past, with parks, groves, ponds and ramparts, a delightful place. Then the man would inform the king or a royal minister and say, Sire, know that while wandering through the forest I saw an ancient path, an ancient road, and followed it and saw an ancient city, an ancient capital with parks, groves, ponds and ramparts. Renovate that city, sire. Then the king or royal minister would renovate the city, and sometime later that city would become successful and prosperous, well populated, filled with people, attained to expansion and growth. So too, monks, says the Buddha, I saw the ancient path, the ancient road travelled by the Buddhas of the past. And what is that ancient path, that ancient road? It is just this noble eightfold path, that is, appropriate seeing, thought, speech, action, livelihood, resolve, mindfulness, and concentration. And I followed that path, and by doing so, I came to know suffering and craving, the cessation of craving, and the path itself. Now, here we have a metaphor that is concerned not with the goal of breaking free of birth and death, as in classical Indian thought, but rather we have a path that leads to a city. And that city, in this metaphor, is what the Buddha calls the Four Ennobling Truths. I'm going to go into that part in a moment. But first of all, I'd like to just look at what this metaphor might have been referring to at his time. I suspect for us, or for many of us, when we listen to that story of the ancient path and the ancient city in the jungle, a picture perhaps of Mayan temples in the South American jungle sprang to mind, or whatever you may have had that in your memory, in your experience, that would somehow ring true with this metaphor. Now what this means is that the Buddha's evoking a metaphor as a didactic device. But for a metaphor to be effective, people have to be familiar with that image. For example, if you don't know what a gerbil is, you'll say, well, it's a bit like a mouse, it's a bit like a hamster. Oh, right, okay. Now, the problem is that at the time the Buddha was teaching, in the northern Gangetic plains, there were no ruined cities in the forests. They didn't exist. The Aryan invaders who had entered into the northern parts of India about 1,000 years before the Buddha's birth had not established cities until about a century or so before the Buddha himself. The society evolved initially as small tribal clans, which became small confederates and republics, very rural, very small, and the building materials they used were wood, mud, wattle and daub type structures, or sun-baked brick. They did not have, in northern India at that period, the technology of kiln-fired brick. In other words, building materials that would survive. And as anyone who's been to India knows, particularly North India, every year you get a lot of rain. That even if some of these early settlements had survived, they would have very quickly been eroded by water. So we know from archaeology that there were no ancient cities in the forests, ancient paths leading to them, anywhere in the region where the Buddha would have taught. So what's he referring to? How could that metaphor have served as a useful didactic device? I think there's only one solution to this problem. Namely, that these people were aware of vast ruined cities which had been abandoned up to about 500 or 1,000 years before the Buddha, that existed in the Indus Valley. Mohenjo-daro and Harappa, these are now well-known sites, and they are vast cities made of kiln-fired brick, i.e. non-degradable materials. It seems that this knowledge of these places would have been quite widespread for a number of reasons. The trade routes from central India, North India, all converged in the city of Taxila, which is now near modern-day Islamabad. And in fact, the Indus Valley city ruins are all in modern Pakistan. There would have been a lot of traffic, people bringing information, telling about these places. I think it's even possible, as a young man, the Buddha himself might have gone out to that western region. It's also possible that the Aryan people, when they came from Central Europe or somewhere to the north, when they came through into the Gangetic Plain, they would have passed through these areas. It would have been part of their historical knowledge. And they would have had this collective awareness of a civilization, cities, built of weird materials, bricks, that would have been a very imposing presence for people just at the beginning of urban development. The very first primitive sort of towns that were being built before and just around the Buddha's time. Now this, of course, forces us to think of the Buddha in a very different light. He's not a prince who grew up in palaces. There were no palaces. At best, they were rather grandiose, wattle and daub structures with thatched roofs. Nothing more than that. So, it seems from this analogy that the Buddha was conscious of greater civilizations that had existed in the past and that had been lost and destroyed and abandoned. They would not have known why any more than we know. We don't quite know why they were abandoned. And he sees his teaching, therefore, as a way to restore a kind of civilization. Now that, I think, is quite clear from this passage, that he sees his middle way, his eightfold path, as leading to a city. And how does he describe that city? He describes the city as the knowing of suffering, of craving, of cessation, and the path again. In other words, four ennobling truths. If we look at the four truths in this way, then we must consider them as a template for a way of life that would give rise to a kind of culture, perhaps a civilization, and that would be the goal of the path. Remember, when we describe the four truths, there's suffering, then what is usually called the origin of suffering, or craving, is the second, cessation of craving is the third, and the Noble Eightfold Path is the fourth. In other words, there seems to be a progression towards a path, towards a way of life that embraces all aspects of our humanity. The way we see things, think, speak, act, and quite specifically the way we earn our living, livelihood. And only on that basis do we then find mindfulness, concentration, and so on. Let's look at how the Buddha himself describes his enlightenment, his awakening. This is from his first sermon, the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, the discourse of turning the wheel of Dhamma. And he says, "As long as my knowledge and vision was not entirely clear in 12 ways about the reality of the four truths, I did not claim to have had a peerless awakening in this world, with its humans and celestials, its gods and devils, its ascetics and priests. Only when my knowledge and vision was clear in all these ways, did I claim to have had such awakening." So he doesn't say that his enlightenment or his awakening was an insight into some grand mystical truth, into something like the unconditioned or the deathless, which are terms often used in Buddhism today, or an insight into emptiness or into selflessness or into the true nature of mind. That language is quite alien to this discourse. Nor does he say that he gained some insight into truth with a capital T. On the contrary, he says, as long as my knowledge and vision was not clear in 12 ways about 4 truths. This is a complex understanding. And in fact, it's not just an understanding. In fact, it is the consequence of having recognized, performed, and completed a set of tasks. So the 4 truths are really 4 tasks, 4 things to be done. The first truth, suffering, is to be fully known. The second truth, craving, is to be let go of. The third truth, the stopping of craving, is to be experienced directly. And the fourth truth, the path, is to be cultivated, created, literally brought into being. So we have here something that's not really what we would think of as a mystical experience that would be the domain of the solitary meditating monk, but rather we have a set of tasks that would engage any human being who seeks meaning, who seeks to realize what their life is capable of. And it presents us with a process rather than some kind of state of understanding. So the 4 truths, therefore, are dynamic. There is a movement through a sequence of phases. And let's have a look at that, because I feel that it's that that provides us with a framework for the practice of mindfulness, for example, or full awareness. We have to really know, well, why would we do that? Why should we practice mindfulness? What's the purpose of it? What's the point? The point is that it enables us to embrace suffering. Now let's pause for a moment. Suffering is one of these words that is used a great deal in Buddhism, and it often gives the sense of something rather gloomy and morbid, pessimistic. That would be the case if knowing suffering was an end in itself, but it's not. It's the first phase in a process, in a way of life, that leads to the letting go of a certain relationship with life, premised on clutching, clinging, and it opens up other possibilities, other ways of being in this world. So fully knowing dukkha is about embracing the tragic dimension of life. As the Buddha himself describes it, he says, birth is painful. Aging is painful. Sickness is painful. Death is painful. Encountering what is not dear is painful. Separation from what is dear is painful. Not getting what one wants is painful. And I still don't feel entirely comfortable with the word painful. Some colleagues have suggested that we need to stop trying to find a word in English for dukkha and just try to import the word dukkha into the English language. I'm not convinced that's going to work. I think we perhaps need to reconfigure how we understand this term suffering in a Buddhist context. It refers to our immediate encounter with life itself. The word dukkha encompasses, for example, impermanence, change, transience. There's nothing intrinsically painful about that, but what it points to is that life is something that's constantly moving on, constantly shifting and changing. Of course, on one hand, it means things are always decaying, risking being lost, breaking down, fracturing. But at the same time, that very process of change is what affords the possibility of new beginnings, of something else, of other alternatives. Things are not fixed. Things can be changed. I am not fixed. My attitudes and opinions and perceptions are not fixed. They too can change. Impermanence is both a recognition of the inevitable entropy of existence, but at the same time, it's what allows for the possibility of insight, of compassion, of transformation, and any kind of change. So this goes under the broad heading of dukkha. Even something like death. When I was a monk, one of the meditations that we were instructed to do on a daily basis was the meditation on death. And we would reflect upon the certainty of death. The only thing that is certain in our future is that we will die. Everything else is uncertain. And yet this one certain thing can occur at any time. Its time is quite uncertain. Now, again, intellectually, we might say, well, I know that. It's obvious, isn't it? If we start to think about it, though, if we start to meditate on it, reflect deeply about this, and also integrate it into our sense of ourselves, our sense of our world, if we try to embody that understanding, the strange consequence is that it doesn't lead to feeling depressed or gloomy or morbid. Strangely, it makes us much more aware of the fact that we are alive, that we become infused with a sense of our own and the world's vitality. And it becomes that much more precious in a way that here we are, alive, conscious, more or less in good health, and this won't last. We know it won't last. It's therefore an encouragement to live this moment fully and totally. The practice of mindfulness, I feel, is doing exactly the same thing. It might, especially when you start doing it, feel a bit boring and a bit contrived, and it doesn't seem to have an enormous effect. You might get some nice kind of nice, still, peaceful moments every now and again. But over time, if you begin to practice and train yourself in such a way, I find that it leads to a heightened sense of the beauty of the world. Of the preciousness of this very fragile and vulnerable thing called life. And as we begin to experience ourselves not as separate egos struggling to prevail over other separate egos, insisting on our position and our importance and so on, and all the stuff that our wandering mind tends to keep circling around. But the more that we begin to confront this this open field of contingent and impermanent events within us and without us, begins to undermine the whole strategy of living in order to get things, in order to get rid of things, to be prompted and pushed and pulled by our likes, our dislikes, our fears, our attachments, our greed, and so forth and so on. So the practice of mindfulness, the practice of full awareness, is a practice of embracing dukkha, embracing suffering in its broadest sense. And that leads, quite naturally, quite organically, to a letting go of grasping. When we see the things, when we really know things, we sense, we intuit the ephemerality of life and ourselves and our friends and our family, we're going to be less prone to try to fix them, to hold them, to clutch onto things for security, to crave permanence in a radically impermanent world. It will begin to alter our relationship to our lives. And that is called, in this framework, letting go. Letting go of grasping, of clinging, of clutching, of holding, and in doing so, giving oneself more unconditionally and totally to what is arising moment to moment, and how we might respond to that, not from our reactive patterns of habitual thinking, but from a recognition and an appreciation of the uniqueness and the and in a sense sometimes the simple tragic nature of the situation we're encountering. And such letting go will then lead to moments of stillness, perhaps, of openness, of a kind of veridical or truthful encounter with the condition of our humanity, the condition of our world. And from there, there is the possibility of living from another perspective, which the Buddha calls the Eightfold Path. Now that's a very brief summary of the Four Truths. But as we can see, when you see the Four Truths as four tasks, you see how each task becomes the precondition for the next. By embracing pain, we create the condition for letting go of grasping. By letting go of grasping, we create the possibility of not grasping at all. And that, in fact, is what means the word nirvana. It doesn't mean anything else. The nirvana is just the stopping, maybe only momentarily, of that set of habit patterns that wants to impose fixity and control and permanence on transient ephemeral conditions. And the life that then follows from that affirmation that the world is like this gives us a foundation for living from another perspective. And this path, as the Buddha then says clearly in his metaphor, leads to the possibility of another civilization, another city. In Christian terms, we might talk of the kingdom. And that seems to have been a very explicit part of how he saw the value of his teaching. And from this perspective, we're not clearly simply talking about what monks and nuns do in the solitude of their contemplation. We're talking very much about a total way of living in this world. Now, we do find, and admittedly these passages are few and far between, but since there's about 6,000 pages of text in the Pali Canon, if you go through it, if you can stand going through some of the more boring passages, suddenly you stumble across little nuggets of gold that are oddly of a different tone, of a different feel to the rather repetitive and laborious emphasis on attaining liberation from birth and death. This is a passage I stumbled across in a text called the Udana, which is a short collection of passages. This is the Buddha speaking. He says, "What has been attained and what is still to be attained, both these are littered with dust for a frail person." In other words, they're things that we can get really confused about. "Those who hold training as the essence, or who hold virtue and vow as the essence, or hold pure livelihood, celibacy and service as the essence, this is one dead end. And those who hold such theories and such views as there is nothing wrong with sensual desires, this is the second dead end. Both these dead ends cause the cemeteries to grow, and the cemeteries cause opinions to grow. By not penetrating these two dead ends, some hold back and some go too far." Now this is a very uncharacteristic passage, and you wonder, where did this come from? What is quite clear about it, and what the commentators have to bend over backwards to explain away, is that the Buddha seems to be pointing to a middle way that avoids two dead ends. It's usually translated as extremes, the middle way between two extremes. The word being translated is anta. It doesn't mean extreme. It means limit or end. In fact, the devil, Mara, is called the antaka, the one who imposes limits, dead ends. So a path is the opposite of a dead end. In other words, it actually goes somewhere. Dead ends bring you up to a wall where you can't go any further. Now what the Buddha seems to be suggesting here is that the way of life that he envisions is one that avoids the dead ends of religiosity. And he says, you know, all these things, virtue and vow, celibacy, even service. It's quite striking. He seems to see how the overt religious mindset can be very much a dead end. For a start, you could become rather holier than thou about it. One can become rather attached to it and thereby rather negative about everything that fails to meet your high values and standards. And the other extreme, the other dead end, is a life lived purely in pursuit of the gratification of one's sense desires. In other words, a kind of a life that is, in a sense, more driven than anything else. This endless search for gratification. So he's not encouraging that, but he's also, at the very least, putting considerable caveats around being too religious. But however we read it, this is a quite unusual way of presenting the middle path. The middle way. And the middle way, remember, is synonymous to the Eightfold Path. It's suggestive, I think, that when we practice such a path, we don't get caught up in it being religious and precious in that sense, but nor do we simply pursue mindlessly sensory pleasure or intellectual pleasure. So it's neither hedonistic, but nor is it a practice of renunciation. It's a way of life that embraces all of our humanity and is quite alert to the dangers of either excessive religiosity or excessive hedonism. The same idea, or a similar idea, is also there in terms of his understanding of the person. Now this is another problem we have with Buddhism, and that is this idea that to be a good Buddhist you have to not be a self anymore. And you know, the idea of anatta, which I'm not going to go into in any detail here, is so often seen as a way to a way of self-abnegation, a way of seeing that your ego or yourself is somehow a problem, and that to be liberated from the troubled world you need to be liberated from your ego, that you try to no longer have a self, you just experience your body and mind as fleeting elements, but there's no self, there's no person who somehow is present among such elements. Now this, I think, is very much the sort of thing emphasized in mystical contemplation. In other words, the preserve of monastics. But we have another way of looking at self, which goes right to the earliest sources of tradition, that presents a quite different picture. This is the verse 80 of the Dhammapada. The Buddha says, just as a farmer irrigates his field, just as the fletcher fashions an arrow, just as a carpenter shapes a block of wood, so the sage or the wise person tames the self. Attanam Dhammati Pandita. I came across this verse when I was studying Pali, in a sort of Pali for Dummies book, and it gave this verse as a basically a grammatical exercise. And what struck me was that the word self was in the accusative singular, the direct object of the verb. The very same word self as in not self or no self. And here, quite explicitly, the self is compared to a field, the self is compared to an arrow, the self is compared to a block of wood. And once again, as we saw in the example this morning, the Buddha is taking examples from the world of the craftsperson, or the worker, the farmer, the arrowsmith, the sculptor, or the carpenter, which of course resonates with what I was saying about how these silent, non-verbal artifacts communicate, at least at some degree, the values of Buddhist culture. So here the person is seen as not as something that doesn't really exist, but really as a project that has not yet been realized. That the person is a process like anything else, impermanent, ephemeral, not going to be around for very long. And yet this particular passage here suggests that one's practice is not just about monastic-like contemplation, but the practice is about transfiguring in some way the elements of who you are. We take the example of the field. If we are like a field, then through irrigating the field, we allow crops and plants and so forth to grow and flourish. It's very much a metaphor of life. And the implication, of course, is that we don't irrigate ourselves. We don't let water flow through us. Again, it's reminiscent of the metaphor of entering the stream or entering the path. It's a water metaphor. So the idea is that the practice of the Dhamma, whether that be the practice of mindfulness, the practice of concentration, or whatever it might be, is in fact a kind of irrigation. It's opening up channels and irrigation courses that allow the energies of our life, as it were, to become opened up in a way that was previously blocked. In this way, the idea of Buddha, especially in contrast to Mara, the demonic, is very much a metaphor for life, the flowing of water that nourishes us in such a way that we can grow. Or, in the case of the arrowsmith, we can, as it were, organize ourselves, or, as we say in colloquial English, we can get ourselves together in such a way that our life can become more directed towards the realization of our goals, like an arrow. A well-made arrow can be fired to its target, and it can seek and find its target with precision and speed. This is not the idea of someone who has no self. And likewise, a block of wood. We're like, as it were, our mind, our bodies, our emotions, our feelings are like uncarved blocks of wood. So through training, through ethics, through discipline, through meditation, through reflection, through study, through work, we begin to modify ourselves, to become, as it were, skilled in areas that previously we were unskilled. We begin to evolve, we begin to develop, we begin to change. And all of this is not so much about self-transcendence, but rather about transcendence of our limitations, transcendence of what impedes the possibility of living fully in the world. It's about overcoming fear and hesitation. It's about also going beyond limitations imposed upon us by our social conditioning, the desires of our families, of our culture, the expectations of others. It's recognizing that we do not have to introject the limits that others or society or a religious belief or a political belief might start to impose upon us. So it's very much a vision of a certain kind of freedom. Now, finally, one more metaphor. This is also from the Udana, which is a short collection of early texts. The Buddha compares his teaching, his community, to an ocean. He says, my teaching is like an ocean. And in the same way, the rivers of the world empty into the ocean, and in so doing, lose their identity as rivers. In other words, the Ganges, once it goes into the Bay of Bengal, is no longer the Ganges. In the same way, the castes of men in his time, the priests, the nobility, the merchants, the laborers, by entering into his community, lose their identity. They lose their fixed identity, which in India was divinely ordained. And then he goes on to say, in the next development of this metaphor, he says, just as salt, the taste of salt, permeates the ocean, so does the taste of freedom permeate my teaching and my community. So we have an image here of another kind of society. A society that's not dictated by the privileges or the lack of privilege of one's station in life, at birth, or through background or whatever, but is determined by how you manage to fashion and create your own sense of being a person. So, freedom, and this metaphor is often this idea that the flavor of freedom permeates my teaching like salt does the ocean, is so often interpreted as meaning spiritual freedom, liberation from birth and death or something. But here it quite clearly refers to a kind of social freedom, an individual freedom, a recognition that each person is free to create themselves according to their deepest yearnings and intuitions and values. And so he kind of envisages a sort of proto-meritocracy, a proto-democracy also. And in fact he models his community on a republican assembly rather than the rule of kings. He doesn't appoint a successor. He sees his Dhamma as an impersonal law of values and precepts, practices, that governs the life of the community without anyone being appointed as the head of it or the ruler, the leader. Now all of this, I feel, if we begin to look at Buddhist texts and early teachings, very core teachings after all, four truths and so on, begins to allow us to reconfigure these ideas, these doctrines, in a way that is no longer the exclusive preserve of world-renouncing monks and nuns. It may be that we also need to reconsider what it means to be a layperson, not merely as the opposite of a monk, which is the Buddhist way of thinking very often, but rather to consider what would be the optimal way in which I can live, whereby I can embody and realize the sorts of values, both individually and socially, that are implicit and in some senses explicit in these primary Buddhist ideas. And I'm going to stop there.